Today's Serving Sunday. You think, well, what's Serving Sunday all about? You might have picked up some clues by now. But it's something we want to do every year around about this time. And hopefully as the years go by, we'll get better and better at it. And we'll find different ways of expressing our love and our gratefulness to the number of people that serve us every week in the church in all sorts of different ways. Some hidden, some obvious. And we just think it's really important to value one another like this, to actually take some time, take a whole Sunday morning just to say thank you for what you've done. We don't want to take one another for granted. And we're going to come back to this a bit later on, because we're actually going to do that. We're actually going to thank some of these people. Not everybody that I want to thank is actually here this morning, but I'm going to say their names on the tape so that they can listen to us thanking them and hopefully hear you thanking them as well. Although the microphone's not so good at picking up the room. But before I sort of get onto that, going through the list of people, I want to talk quite reasonably briefly about serving and servanthood. And I want to talk about that from two passages, starting in John 13, where Jesus washes his disciples' feet, and then Luke 22. And we're going to kind of flip between those two passages, because the chronology then will make sense of what actually happened that led up to Jesus washing the disciples' feet. So if you want to keep your finger in both John 13 and John 22, as I said, we'll be flipping between the two a little bit. Luke 22 was a passage where Jesus said some pretty important things about serving, which we want to pick up on as well. Now, if we start in John 13, this is a very familiar story to a lot of us. It's the story where Jesus and his friends have a very important meal together, but the foot washer doesn't turn up. The foot washer doesn't show up. So let's just read verse 1. John 13, verse 1, first of all. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. So that sets the context of this story. It was just before the meal, and Jesus and his disciples are gathered together, and he has a responsibility to show them the full extent of his love. And it's an important meal in the calendar. We might not perhaps realize the significance and importance of it. We're not Israelites in that sense. But it was a very important meal. All the disciples would have taken their very best of care to dress up, to smell nice. They would have bathed and all the rest, a yearly bath perhaps, on that evening. They would have come in their best clothes. But this was in a time and in a place where they would have worn sandals, and they would have walked down really dirty roads, and dusty roads as well. So they would have come in somewhat dirty around the feet area, and they would eat their meals around low tables. And the way they would do that is to recline on benches. So if you imagine these dirty, smelly feet, where are they? They're in front of your neighbor's face. So you're lying on tables, and your feet are there for everybody to display, to see, and to smell, no doubt. So it was pretty important that their feet were washed when they came to a meal. Otherwise, it'd be rather off-putting. I don't know if you've ever sat down to a meal with a smelly person, but it does kind of spoil the food somewhat. I was actually thinking about when we had babies and one of the babies needed the nappy change, but there you go, that's what was going through my mind. I don't know what was going through yours. But custom required that what would happen is that there would be a slave or a very low servant who would greet you at the door, greet your guests at the door, and they would wash your feet even before you came into the house. But for some reason, something had gone wrong. The foot washer had not turned up. I mean, imagine the scene. Luke 22:14 puts us in the chronological order here because it tells us that they're just arriving or just arrived. And they're reclined at the table, their dirty feet all for to display. What are they going to do? What are they going to do? I don't know if you've ever been to an important meal and you realise that you've not dressed right, there's something not right, you've forgotten something, and there's that awkward moment. What am I going to do about it? What are they going to do about it? Do I go out again and wash my feet because I've come all the way this way now, I've got my place, and I realise that my feet are dirty? Do I go out and wash them again? Is somebody else going to do it? Perhaps one of the other disciples? Maybe they've been asked to do it. Maybe they're going to come in with a bowl in a minute. Maybe that's the way it's going to be solved. Maybe I should do it. Maybe I should go out. But then, hold on a minute, I'd lose my place at the table. And I have actually got myself a rather good place at the table, right at the head, just about where Jesus is going to sit. And you know those disciples. I'll lose my place. No, I'll stay here. Hopefully one of the other disciples will get round to it. Well, James hasn't arrived yet. James arrives. He sizes up the situation. He looks around. No foot washer. He looks around a bit more. Ha! The way John is eyeing me, he's expecting me to do it. James and John are brothers. There's some rivalry between them. Well, I'm no slave. I'm no foot washer. I'm going to be the leader of the church in Jerusalem. Doesn't he know that? I'm not doing it. James arrives, then perhaps Philip comes in. Same thing, he looks around, sees what needs doing, doesn't do it. Peter comes in, he loudly sees what's going on and loudly does nothing about it. Then Thomas comes in, well, he doesn't even believe in foot washers or that they exist. So Thomas doesn't do anything about it. By this time, they're all sat around the table. And this so often can be our experience, can't it, of church life. There's a job that needs to be done, but it's always somebody else's job, even though we were the one that saw that it needed to be done. It was somebody else's job. A pastor friend of mine told me recently that they came to the end of one morning meeting. It had been a particularly busy time. He was feeling a bit tired, and some lovely lady came up and said, "Somebody needs to clean the carpet in the creche room." And he sort of looks at her and says, "Right. Well, somebody needs to clean it." "Oh, you want me to clean the carpet? Ah, right, okay. Well, there's some stuff over there. Why don't you just go and clean it up?" But the implication was, no, it's your job. You're the leader here. You're the full-time pastor. You've got hours to do these kinds of things. Why don't you get it done a bit later on in the week when you've got nothing else to do? So he was a little bit miffed, as you can imagine. And I can just imagine Jesus entering the room. He looks at the water, he looks at the filthy feet of his disciples, and you can see it in his eyes. You know, 3 years of teaching, illustrating, modelling. Silently, he looks around and takes his place. Well, perhaps now they'll get it. Now Jesus is here. When they see Jesus is here, when they remember that this is a meal in his honour, perhaps then they'll get it. Perhaps then they'll remember. Perhaps they'll remember it's his church that we're talking about here, where there are people that need serving. Perhaps when Jesus turns up, they'll get it. You know, sometimes church life reminds me a bit of a story I heard about four people. I don't know if you've heard this. Everybody, somebody, anybody, and nobody. Here's how it goes. Have you heard this? There was an important job to be done, and everybody was asked to do it. Everybody was sure that somebody would do it. Anybody could have done it, but nobody did it. Somebody got angry because it was everybody's job. Everybody knew that anybody could do it, but nobody realized that somebody wouldn't do it. And everybody blamed somebody because in the end, nobody did what anybody could have done. So the disciples have got this problem. What are they going to do about it? Well, Luke 22 tells us what the disciples did about it. Let's just look in Luke 22, verse 23 and 24. In fact, just verse 24. This is what the disciples did about it. a dispute arose among them as to which of them was considered to be the greatest. Which of us is the greatest? Oh, it shouldn't be me. It shouldn't be you. It shouldn't be any of us. Which of us is the greatest? It's amazing how a menial task can bring out the worst of us sometimes. Now, if you asked me to do something great, Naaman said, with leprosy, I would have done it. But because you've asked me to go and do that, I don't want to do that. You know, if you'd asked me to do something great, if you'd asked me to stand up the front and do this or that, or if you'd asked me to do something that had profile or significance, if you asked me to do that kind of thing, I'd have done it, but you've just asked me to clear away some chairs or pick up some litter from the floor, the menial. There's no better way to test what it really means, what it is really in a man or a woman's heart, than to see what they do and to see how they respond when they're asked to do something menial or lowly. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that it's wrong to aspire to greatness. Interestingly, Jesus doesn't rebuke them for it. He doesn't say that they're wrong to talk about who's going to be the greatest. He'd have thought that Jesus, probably I, would have corrected them. Come on, humble yourself, all the rest. But Jesus didn't rebuke them. Actually, in verse 30 of chapter 22 of Luke, he confirms it by talking about the thrones they will eventually sit on in his kingdom and the table that they will sit at with him in his kingdom. It's not wrong to have an ambition or aspiration for greatness. It's not a godly quality to always want the less, always want the least. Oh, I'm just happy with the scraps from under the table. Or I'm just happy to, you know, serve when nobody sees what I'm doing. No. And you get these kind of poor, downtrodden Christian types. They're just so meek and humble, you don't even know that you're walking on them. That's not right either. You know, I've met Christians who don't think it's right to stand up for themselves in the workplace. People that have been in abusive marriages don't think it's been right to stand up against it and say, that's wrong. People that have had other things happen to them, I'm a Christian, therefore I've got to be down on myself or low in some way. Not to have ambition or aspiration is not a godly quality. And I think some of us need to be aspiring for greatness today. Aspiring for greatness. You know, there are leadership positions in workplaces that people need to own up to. There are places of influence that God wants some of you to have in our society today. There are responsibilities that need to be owned in families, in marriages, in the wider community. And to have real godly aspiration, to be prepared to put your neck on the block, to stand up and say what needs to be said, to do what needs to be done, actually requires courage. And it requires a certain energy that comes from God-induced ambition. See, Jesus didn't rebuke them for aspiring to greatness. He rebukes them for aspiring to the wrong kind of greatness. Let's just read Luke 22. 25 to 27. Luke 22, 25 to 27. So the dispute arose in verse 24. Then in verse 25, Jesus said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors." That was the wrong kind of authority, the wrong kind of ambition, lording it over people. Superior in attitude. But you are not to be like that, verse 26. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the least or the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is not the one who is at the table, but I am among you as one who serves. Not lording over people. That's not the kind of leadership Jesus is looking for. That's not the kind of authority that Jesus wants to see modelled through his church. Not lording. Gracious. Loving. Verse 27, Jesus says, who is greater? He says, is it the servants? And just imagine the scene, because by now it says that the meal is being served. So we've gone from just before the meal, where everybody sees the problem, and we've gone to the position now where the servants have come in and they're beginning to serve the meal. I don't know if you noticed that, but that's where they're at now. They are actually starting to get their food. And Jesus is almost sort of using this opportunity, this illustration, as he so often does, out of the circumstances around him. He says, just have a look around. So who's greater then? Us, we're being served right now. We're being served right now. Who's greater, us or the servants that are serving? And Jesus, well, obviously we are. We're the ones that are sat down and eating. And so, you know, from the worldly perspective, we're the greatest. But Jesus says, but I'm among you. And I've come amongst you as one who serves. And this is the context in which Jesus then gets up from the table. Whilst a meal is being served, and let's look in John 13 again. John 13, verses 2 to 5. While the meal was being served, the evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and he'd come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. During the meal, while the meal was being served, while the other servants were working, Jesus got up. And it says he removed his clothes. He removed his priestly garment. He removed the symbol of his authority. He removed the reason for their respect for him. He took it off and he wrapped himself instead and dressed himself like a slave. He just wrapped a towel around him. And then he came to wash their feet. You know, as the teacher, Jesus could rightly have expected, just so that you understand the context here, Jesus could rightly have expected his disciples to do all sorts of menial tasks for him. That was part of the deal of discipleship. So they would have made his food for him. They would have made sure his lodgings were sufficient for him. They would have done all sorts of practical things. You remember the story of the woman at the well, where his disciples went into the town to get food for him. Did you bring the bread, Simon? They bring the bread. They look after his material needs. But washing Jesus' feet was too low even for them. That would have been considered to be a misuse or abuse of his disciples. That was too lowly even for them. And so here is Jesus, even lower. Because of his height, sometimes we think, oh, Jesus, you're so meek and mild and humble. But he's only so meek and mild and humble when you consider the height to which he has come from. When you consider his greatness and his majesty as the Lord of all heaven, the Lord of the whole earth, the whole universe, that he spoke into being with just a word of command. That's the one who is washing my feet. Look at the distance. If the disciples did it, it wouldn't be such a great distance, would it? It's just kind of one beneath them. But for Jesus, I came to serve, Jesus said. Jesus demonstrates what he has just taught them. The greatest serving the least. The one who rules like the one who serves. You know, apart from the incredibleness of his greatness compared to the, our opposite of greatness, it's nothing compared to the culture shock that these disciples would have had with Jesus doing this. We can see his greatness and his exalted majesty. We understand the story and how it turns out and how he's been exalted to the right hand of the majesty on high. They were still trying to work this out. But even culturally, you think about it, these disciples were born and raised in the Roman time, where their leaders would exercise authority in cruel and harsh ways, where the Romans would have power literally over life or death, where they could do just about whatever they wanted. Julius Caesar, just centuries before, had conquered the whole world with and killed off whole races of people with impunity. That was authority. That was the kind of power that they were used to seeing. And they would see riches exploiting people, positions being given to the rich, and the poor being downtrodden and undermined and having no sense of justice. That was the context in which the disciples lived. And so Jesus is modeling a kind of authority that is so foreign to them just from the point of view of their culture. This isn't what they expect of the Messiah, of the King, of the Lord of all. This isn't what they expect from somebody who's going to come and save them from this oppression. Jesus is washing my feet, the lowest job in the house. I don't know if you can understand just how humbling it must have been for them to see Jesus serving them like that. I don't know if you've ever had somebody wash your feet and what that felt like. And perhaps maybe wash your feet is, that's kind of a picture of somebody doing something for you that's incredibly humbling. Somebody really puts themselves up. Some great person does something for you, and you just feel so humbled by what they're doing. Why would you do that for me? Why would you come and visit me? Why would you come and spend time with me? Maybe you've not had that experience. I have. I've been so touched by some people who've served me, and I've not known what to do with myself because I just feel so overwhelmed by, why would you do this? Why would you spend this kind of time with me? Interestingly, it seems that this was only too much for one of them. Only one of them actually said, no, Lord. Because by this time, let's just read it, John 13:6-12. He came to Simon Peter. He'd presumably already done some of the other disciples' feet. But when he came to disciple number Simon Peter, it was too much for him. He said, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? Now, what's the emphasis in that sentence? What is the emphasis? I don't know. I'd love to have actually heard. Lord, are you going to wash my feet? Lord, are you going to wash my feet? Lord, are you going to wash my feet? What's the emphasis? But you can just see here the shock, the tone of horror in what Peter is saying. Lord, you're going to wash my feet? Jesus replied, you don't know what I'm doing, but later you will understand. No, said Peter, you shall never wash my feet, Jesus answered. Unless I wash you, you will have no part with me. Then, Lord, Simon Peter replied, not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well. Jesus answered, a person who's had a bath to come to this feast needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean. And you are clean, but not all of you. For he knew who was going to betray him. When he had finished washing their feet, verse 12, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. Do you understand what I've done for you? I just think it's fascinating that only Peter was the one to respond. At least he's the only one that was recorded as responding in this way. And I don't know how to read this response in some ways. Was it, you shall not wash my feet, Lord, you're forgetting yourself? A recognition of who Jesus really was that Peter had acknowledged? Lord, are you forgetting yourself? You shouldn't be doing this. Was it kind of a humility that he didn't want to see Jesus lower himself like that? Or was it pride? Was it pride that... I don't know if you've discovered this. There are some people in the world who love to serve but resist being served. I don't want your charity. I don't mind week in, week out serving others. I like that. That's the way around it should be. But you try and do something for me, you'll be in trouble. There are people like that, even in the church. They love to serve others, but they don't want to be served themselves. So was there a mixture of humility and pride, or was it just pride? I don't know. We'll have to ask him when we see him. But Jesus said to Peter, you don't understand. You don't get what I'm doing. You don't know the kingdom that I come from. It's a different kind of kingdom. Because in this kingdom where I'm coming from, Jesus says, the king serves the servants. The king serves the servants, not the other way around. The king gets down off his throne. He gives you thrones to sit on. He has you sitting at the table with him, and he washes your feet and serves you. That's the kind of kingdom I come from, and that's what I want to see modeled through you. Upside down thinking, as it's often called. You don't get it now, but you'll understand it later. Peter, you don't realize how much I actually want to do this for you. Jesus wasn't reluctant. He wasn't thinking, oh, well, nobody else will do it. Come on then, just take my clothes off, get the towel on. Oh, crumbs, these guys. I mean, they should know by now. Jesus was in his element serving them. He says, you don't know how much I actually want to do this for you, how much you actually need it. Peter, it is my greatest desire to lower myself and wash you to help you. I think Peter somehow gets it. He says, not just my feet then, but all of me. And it's wonderfully heartfelt. But even now, Peter, you're not quite getting it. You're not quite seeing it. Because you're kind of telling Jesus what to do. Oh, well, you better wash this, you better wash that, you better wash... Hold on, wash all of me. Jesus says, no. That's not the way it goes. I know what you need right now. You need your feet washed. You don't need all that other stuff. Let me serve you where I see your need, Jesus says. Peter, you only need your feet washed. And you know, many of us have been inspired by Jesus' example here. And we've kind of tried to live out the servanthood that Jesus models. And some have even taken it to the extreme of literally having foot washing ceremonies in church. Next week, maybe? I don't know. But this misses the point. Because if we're not careful, we are actually responding to this episode in Jesus' ministry in the same way as Peter. Peter was saying, Lord, you shall not serve me, let me serve you. The point is not that we serve, but that we first recognize our need to be served by Jesus. As Mark Driscoll says in his sermon last Sunday, which I just saw yesterday, so I thought I'd be really live and bang up today. Jesus wants to serve you. Mark Driscoll's preaching on this at the moment. I thought I'd wear the same shirt today. So, yeah. Jesus wants to serve us. I can't get that around. I can't understand that. I can't get that around my thinking. I've been a Christian since I was 4, and I can't get into my head and into my spirit that Jesus doesn't mind when I come to him and I say, Lord, I'm really in a mess right now. I'm desperate for you. Lord, I've really messed up. I need you to heal me. I need you to touch me. I need you to change me. Lord, I need you to serve me. I need you to serve me, the King of Heaven. Well, surely shouldn't I be serving him? Am I being too selfish in the way I'm praying? But I'm desperate. I need Jesus to serve me. And this is what he wants. This is the kind of heart he wants. When we come to him, we say, Jesus, I've really messed up. I need you to do something quick. And he responds so quickly. He gets his towel. He comes along, and before you know it, your shoes are off your feet. He's washing you. He's encouraging you. He's loving you. He's showing his grace to you all over again. So the thing is that Jesus washing his disciples' feet is not primarily about what we should do, but what we need. It's only when we see this need and allow Jesus to minister to us that we can then serve one another from a heart that has pure motives. Let me just explain what I mean. Let's just turn to John 13 to 17 now. Do you understand what I have done for you? He asked them. You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your teacher, your Lord, have washed your feet, you should also wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent me. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. This is what he's saying. Don't just copy what I do. That's not good enough. It's when I have washed your feet and you've allowed me to, when you've acknowledged your humility in doing that, that you can then wash somebody else's feet and serve someone else. It's when you have been served by me that you can serve someone else. Otherwise, your motives will get confused. Otherwise, you'll be trying to do some kind of formula. You'll be trying to do some kind of volunteerism, which is all very good, but it doesn't come from the right place. When I have, now that I have washed, now you have benefited from my service of grace, now that I have washed you and you've let me do it, now that you've seen the desperate state of your soul, you can help someone else. Jesus wasn't saying, I'm doing this example so that all of you can do it and look really humble. This is a good idea to look humble in church. We'll have a foot washing ceremony just to show how humble we are. That's not the point. Jesus says, because I've done it for you, now you can do it for someone else. Because I've already broken convention, because I've already changed culture with what I have done and what I have modeled, you can do the same. I have led the way, you follow me and do the same. So what about you? Do you need a Jesus service today? Do you need your feet washed? Do you need some mud that's collected around your life rinsed away? Do you need to turn to Jesus today? Do you need to come to him and let him serve you? Because only then can we serve one another. The reason why some people can't serve, or they do so with reluctance and with difficulty, is because they haven't known the service of Jesus for themselves. They don't do it out of that heart. They serve from a different place. So, for example, we love Jesus. The Bible teaches us because he first loved us. Because we've first been loved by Jesus. We comfort because we have been comforted by the Holy Spirit. We forgive because look what I've been forgiven for. I've got to forgive you. We show mercy because God's grace has been revealed to us, to me. I have to be merciful. When we serve, having first been served by Jesus, having experienced all over again his love, his tenderness, his grace, this transforms our whole motivation. It energizes our gifts and empowers our service so that serving spills out of us and overflows from one heart to another. There's a joy in serving. There's such a privilege in serving because of what Jesus has done for me. Can you imagine what would happen if Jubilee Church really got hold of this? If we really begun to understand where serving comes from and what serving is about. Serving not from reluctance and guilt, but an entire community of people served by God, devoted to one another. Can you imagine the impact? Can you imagine the impact of a church that is falling over one another to serve? Where the rotas, if they're even needed, are overloaded with volunteers. It's my turn. It's my turn. We have disputes over whose turn it is. Can you imagine the impact that that would have on one another? Can you imagine the impact it would have on visitors when they come amongst us, or even the community of Solihull? Can you imagine the impact if we can really get hold of what biblical serving is all about? They wash people's feet in that church. Not literally, but they're such servants. They really know servant Jesus, and they model him. Jesus said, "By this will all men know that you are my disciples, that you love one another." He said, "When you do these things for the least of my brothers, you do it for me." He said, "For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me." When you do these practical things from a servant heart, genuinely servant heart, you do it for the least of my brothers, you're doing it for me. Who are Jesus' brothers? Who are Jesus' brothers? Who do we do it for? For one another. When you do it for the least of these. Now then we could think about, well, who's the least? I'm the greatest, so who's the least? Jesus tells us the greatest is the servant of all. The one who serves the most is the greatest. I don't know who the least is. Work it out. Do you love Jesus? Do you love Jesus? Do you love Jesus this morning? Do you love his church? Do you love Jesus in one another? Then serve. That's the motivation. He's loved me. I want to show love to you. Because he's loved me so much, I want to show my love to you. If Peter thought that Jesus had lowered himself too far by washing his feet, he certainly didn't understand how much lower Jesus was prepared to go to serve us. Jesus says in Matthew 20, "The Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom." Here we can see that ultimately serving is about laying down your life. This is the model that Jesus left for us. This is how the church is meant to look. Servants who serve one another, even down to the laying down of their lives. It's pretty radical stuff. I'm going to miss out a bit because it's going on longer than I thought it would. Sorry. But really, we're talking here about a heart decision. We're not talking about feelings of guilt or anything of the sort. We're talking about a living relationship with Jesus that makes us want to serve because we're so grateful for what he's done for us. You'll be relieved to hear that we're not all called to literally lay down our lives. If we were, there wouldn't be much of a church. But we're not called to lay down our lives in the fullest sense, maybe. Well, some people might be one day. We don't know. But we are all called to serve. And when you consider what it really means to serve and what it ultimately means, it kind of puts things into perspective, doesn't it? When you consider Jesus' example and what he's done to serve us, what an honor it is to lead a life group for Jesus. What an honor it is to set out chairs, to set out the room, to give a cup of tea to somebody, to greet someone, or even to pray for them. What a privilege is that? When we consider what Jesus has done for us. And do you know, at Jubilee, I'm convinced, you might think, with all I've said, oh, I'm having a go. I'm not. I'm really not. I wanted to lay this down and be clear about what biblical serving is. But you know, in Jubilee, we've got a lot of real servants. People that have served year after year after year. People that serve and know how to serve. Doesn't mean we always get it right all the time. We don't get a bit grumpy sometimes. Because sometimes it's just hard work and you just don't feel like there's anybody noticing. Not that we do it for that, but we do. And I think we're speaking here into a place of strength, and I want to encourage you. That's my heart this morning. I want to encourage you and I want to thank you. Jesus said those who serve are the greatest among us. We've got some great people here. And they're not all here today. They're doing great things elsewhere. But we've got some great people today. And so I think it's right that we honour and thank these people with all of our hearts. You know, we couldn't really be church together without some of these people that serve us week after week.